So the next speaker is Frederik Moltmann. The title of the talk, Object-Based Truthmaker Semantics for Different Closed Types. I think you have a copy of the handout in the chat box. And
thank you. Yeah, so I want to talk about how a particular development of truthmaker semantics can be applied to the semantics of different clause types, that is, that clauses on particular readings and WH clauses and infinitival clauses. And this development of truthmaker semantics is what I call object-based truthmaker semantics. And it contrasts with sentence-based truthmaker semantics as developed by Kit Fine and also Stephen Yablo. So sentence-based truthmaker semantics was developed to obtain a fine-grained notion of content for sentences. And then you get notions of subject matter and aboutness, partial content and partial truth. So all these I also want to obtain. And then truthmakers on that approach are, at least on Kit Fine's approach, are states and actions. Actions in particular for imperative sentences, which also on Fine's account have a truthmaker-based semantics. So object-based truthmaker semantics is a view on which truthmaker-based content also holds for mental, illocutionary, and modal objects, which are taken to play a central role in the semantics of attitude reports and modal sentences. And then crucially, sentences are treated as semantic predicates of such objects, such content bearers. So sentences are always treated as predicates of mental, illocutionary, or modal objects, depending on the context in which they occur. So a good part of this talk will consist in outlining this object-based truthmaker semantics, because it has a lot of features that are not, at least to some of you, not familiar. So I will outline object-based truthmaker semantics in application to like simple doxastic attitude reports and then simple modal sentences, and that against the background of sentence-based truthmaker semantics. And then I will show how this object-based truthmaker semantics can be extended to attitude verbs with different sorts of complement clauses. And that I will do by showing that you can add particular sorts of content bearers, like non-worldly facts and states of affairs and also questions, extend the range of truth makers and satisfiers, and add different kinds of truth maker-based sentential meanings. Yeah, so first a few words about sentence-based truthmaker semantics, or Kit Fine's and Yablo's version of truthmaker semantics. So the aim is to obtain a fine-grained notion of content for sentences, which allows for notions of aboutness, partial content, and partial truth. So this is familiar. And then a few basics about of truthmaker semantics in the version that has been developed by Fine. So truthmaking on that view is a relation that holds between situations or actions and sentences, so declarative or imperative sentences. And in fact, then you have truth-making or exact verification and falsification or falsity-making. And then there are truth-making conditions for complex sentences, which are given in 1A through D, which I don't need to go through. And there are also falsification conditions, and that also for complex sentences, like conjunctions and disjunctions, as in 2A and B. And then sentence meanings are construed as bilateral contents, which means they are pairs consisting of a set of verifiers of the sentence and a set of falsifiers of the sentence. So this actually might already raise the question, well, if a sentence is associated with a set of verifiers, would it be possible that a sentence acts as a predicate of such verifiers? And in fact, at the end of the talk, we'll see that there are, in fact, cases in natural language where that is so. Yeah, and then sentence-based truthmaker semantics gives a notion of partial content, which is given in 3. So it's also familiar, and then that has applications as illustrated on the handout. Now I come to object-based truthmaker semantics. So we can start out with the observation that notions of partial content, partial truth, or partial satisfaction, and aboutness also apply to other objects than sentences. So for example, part of applies to things like beliefs, claims, assumptions, desires, requests, decisions, obligations, offers, invitations, and needs. And interestingly, when you apply the expression part of to these various sorts of objects, you always pick out partial content. So a part of a claim is a partial content. A part of a request is a partial content. You cannot possibly understand it as a part of a speech act. That's not how part is understood when you apply to these sorts of objects. Also, a part of an obligation is a partial content. It's not something like a part of a state. A part of an invitation is a partial content, and so for part of an offer, part of a need. So part of an applying to these sorts of things, referred in that sort of way, always picks out partial content. And then you can also apply expressions like partly true, or is partly fulfilled, or is partly satisfied, or is partly taken up, or partly accepted, or partly carried out to these sorts of objects. It depends a bit on the nature of the object, which kind of truth or satisfaction predicate you can apply. So you can apply partly true to a claim or assumption or a belief. You would apply as partly fulfilled or satisfied to a desire or maybe a request. It's partly carried out, can be applied to a thing like a decision. And it was partly carried up, was partly taken up, can be applied to an offer or an invitation. So these sorts of objects come with different kinds of satisfaction predicates, and they all allow for the modification with partly. And of course, one can also apply was about to these various sorts of objects. What we refer to as beliefs, claims, and so on, these come with a content that also divides into partial contents, and they come with different kinds of satisfaction predicates or truth predicates. Now, what sorts of things are these? One might think, well, these are just events or acts. I think that is a real mistake. I think it's a general mistake that philosophers and linguists do, that they always try to apply the notion of an event or an act to so many things. I think these things should be recognized as entities distinct from events or acts. Why? Because events and acts, first of all, do not come with truth or satisfaction conditions. It's completely counterintuitive to say that an event or an act is true or false or is satisfied or is carried out or so. We just don't have those notions applying to events and acts. And then also part of is a notion that clearly applies to our notions of events and acts. And will pick out a temporal part of an event or an act. That's how we understand the notion of an event or an act, or also a state. So they have parts, and these are temporal parts. But part of and applied to these things we refer to as beliefs, claims, assumptions, needs, and so on, can never pick out a temporal part. And rather, it picks out a partial content. And I think this is just very strong evidence that these things are just not on a par with events and acts. They should be recognized as a separate category of objects. Also, they shouldn't be viewed as propositions. Why? Because also propositions do not come with these various sorts of satisfaction conditions. Propositions can be said to be true or false, but they wouldn't be satisfied or taken up or carried out. And then part of actually is not so obviously applicable to propositions in the first place. So what I want to say is that these various entities divide into two sorts, attitudinal objects and modal objects. So attitudinal objects involve a sort of attitudinal mode, like beliefs, claims, assumptions, desires, requests, and decisions are attitudinal objects. Some of them are illocutionary objects, like requests and claims. And then we also have modal objects, and these are obligations, what we refer to as obligations, needs, offers, invitations, permissions, and so on. So attitudinal and modal objects in the sorts of things we refer to as claims, requests, thoughts, assumptions, judgments, intentions, decisions, and so on. So in natural language, we have these various nouns, often nominalizations obtained from attitude verbs, sometimes modal predicates, and they all generally stand for these attitudinal and modal objects. And then how should one approach the ontology of these objects? I think one should first of all focus on the sorts of properties they can naturally have, and that's reflected in the kinds of predicates we can naturally apply to these objects. So they come with particular kinds of predicates that convey truth or satisfaction. They come with the content that divides into partial contents, and they are entities whose properties are reflected in the predicates that are naturally applicable to them. So in particular, they come with a notion of content. And now, among attitudinal objects, one can make finer distinctions. So first, there are act-related attitudinal objects. And some of them one can look at as sort of products produced by an act. So maybe an assumption is something that one produces by making, by assuming something. A decision seems naturally viewable as the product of an act of deciding, and so for a claim and a request and a promise. But there are also act-related attitudinal objects that have more the status of a result rather than a product that was meant to be produced. So a conclusion, a recognition, and a persuasion, for example, would be attitudinal objects that have more of a result-like status. And then there are attitudinal objects that are just not related to acts at all and should certainly be not be viewed as either products or results, like probably beliefs, and then certainly desires, intentions, maybe hopes, fears, and so on. So what is important is that attitudinal objects come with satisfaction conditions, they come with a notion of content, and yet they are concrete, they depend on an agent, they have they enter causal relations to an extent, they can be the object of perception as well. So they are really concrete, mind-dependent objects and sometimes illocutionary objects. Now, why should attitudinal objects be recognized as a separate ontological category? Well, I think really across languages, when you use nouns that are obtained from attitude verbs or that just correspond to attitude verbs, one refers to attitudinal objects and not really to acts or events or states. And then also, I think attitudinal objects really play an important role in our cognitive life. So we remember things like thoughts, desires, experiences, not propositions, not like pure abstract propositions. And it's desires, intentions, and decisions that play a causal role, not abstract propositions. Then I also think that attitudinal and modal objects play a central role in the semantics of attitude reports and modal sentences. So the standard view about propositional attitudes is that propositional attitudes are relations between agents and propositions, where propositions are abstract, shareable truth bearers. Now, this is a view that I do not adopt. rather for me, attitudinal objects play a central role in the semantics of attitude reports. So attitudinal objects sort of take the take on the role of propositions, but in fact in a different way than propositions. They play a different semantic role. And then modal objects are at the center of the semantics of modals, which are no longer treated as sort of quantifiers ranging over worlds. And then crucially, clausal complements, and in fact sentences in general, are treated as semantically as predicates of attitudinal or modal objects. That doesn't mean that they are like assimilated syntactically to predicates. That is not said at all. They are just semantically treated as predicates applying to attitudinal or modal objects. And I think there are particular motivations for that, linguistic motivations for that view as well. So the overall advantages of this approach is that one just avoids the conceptual problems for the notion of a proposition that has been, that have been discussed recently by various philosophers and also actually in the past. One can have a semantics of attitude reports without abstract propositions and without regarding actions or actions types as truth bearers, which I think is problematic. And one can also get an account of the empirical problems that arise on the standard view, which include the actual semantic behavior of quantifiers like something and everything, which in fact do not really stand for propositions. And it also includes the substitution problem and the objectivization effect, which was discussed by a number of people in the past, including myself. Yeah, so now we can turn to how one should construe the content of modal and attitudinal objects in truth-maker terms. So truth-making, crucially, will now be viewed also as a relation between situations or actions and attitudinal or modal objects. So truth-maker semantics, or as one may say, truth-maker theory, would then be a more general theory of content, applying also to mental and illocutionary objects. And then there's also a more specific motivation for applying truth-maker semantics to attitudinal and modal objects, because truth-maker semantics allows for an account of why different modal and attitudinal objects go along with different types of satisfaction predicates. So is true or false, as opposed to is satisfied or fulfilled, as opposed to is accepted or taken on, as opposed to is carried out. And I will indicate some of this now. So first we have modal and attitudinal objects that have truth conditions, which means that can be said to be true or false, or in fact correct or incorrect, where correct and incorrect just mean true or false. So these are modal and attitudinal objects that in Searle's sense have a word mind to world direction of fit. And they come both with a set of satisfiers and with a set of verifiers and with a certain set of falsifiers. So claims, assumptions, beliefs are of that sort. And then we have a category of attitudinal and modal objects that come with fulfillment conditions rather than truth conditions. So they can be said to be satisfied or fulfilled or violated or ignored in the sense of being violated. So requests, demands, desires, hopes, needs, and obligations would be examples of those. They crucially have a world to word mind direction of fit in Searle's sense, and they come both with a set of satisfiers and generally a set of non-empty set of violators. Now, I myself have given in a recent publication an account of the notion of direction of fit in partly in terms of truthmaker semantics. So I will not elaborate this here. I just want to point out that like the first category and the second category are distinguished in those terms. And that is what drives the choice of is true or false as opposed to is satisfied or violated. And then we have a third category. So attitudinal and modal objects that come with a world to word mind direction of fit can be said to be satisfied or fulfilled only if they sort of come with a modal force of necessity. Modal and attitudinal objects that come with a modal force of possibility, one would rather say, are taken up or accepted. And in fact, they cannot be violated. So examples are invitations, offers, permissions. You cannot violate an invitation. You can take it up or not, but if you ignore it, you're not doing anything wrong. You're not violating it. And so for an for an offer. So what distinguishes those modal and attitudinal objects from the first and the second category is really that they come with an empty set of violators. So here we can really just make use of truthmaker semantics to characterize modal and attitudinal objects which go along with satisfaction predicates like take up, accept, by just saying that they come with an empty set of violators. Yeah, now we would like to have a meaning of sentences that would be applicable to all these sorts of attitudinal and modal objects. And in fact, on the basis of these bilateral contents of sentences, one can formulate a meaning of sentences as a property of attitudinal and modal objects that would be applicable to all these various types, and that's given in four. So one takes the sentence with its bilateral content and then maps it onto a property of objects such that the set of verifiers of the object is identical to the set of verifiers of the sentence. And in case the set of falsifiers or violators of the object is not empty, then its set of violators is identical to the set of falsifiers of the sentence. So it's very simple. One just takes care of the possibility that there might be modal and attitudinal objects that have an empty set of violators. Now, how would this meaning of sentences figure in the logical form of attitude reports and modal sentences? Now, very simple logical forms are given in 5 and 6. So John thinks that S is treated as a predicate of an attitudinal object. Now here this will be a thought. And in 5b, I just said that this object is related by some relation R to the Davidsonian event. Now this could be viewed as a product relation or result relation or something else. Here it's just left open. Now in 6, it is necessary that S again is treated as a predicate of objects, as in with a meaning given in 4, and it's predicated here of a modal object, so something roughly speaking a necessity, so which could be an obligation or a need, and it applies just with the meaning in 4. So in 5b and in 6b, the complement clause that S applies just with this meaning in 4 to these two kinds of objects, a thought and, let's say, a need, an attitudinal object and a modal object. And it gives its truth-maker-based content. Now, of course, every semanticist will immediately ask the question, so how do I get these kinds of logical forms compositionally? In fact, that doesn't seem to be so obvious at all. So on the standard view, that S is generally considered is it, like in 5a, that S is considered a complement of things, so it provides an argument of the think relation. And well, if that S is a predicate to be applied to a thought, then we seem to have a problem. So it's not obvious how the logical form in 5b could be possibly be obtained compositionally, how it could go along with what seems to be the syntactic structure of 5a. Now, I think philosophers, and also to a great extent semanticists, were just mistaken in what they took the syntactic structure in 5a to be, namely that that S is just functions as an argument of the predicate think. And what I want to do is focus not so much on a sentence like 5a, or let's say 7a, John claims that S, but rather on a related sentence, which I would say displays the real syntactic structure and thus logical form much better, and that's 7b. So John makes the claim that S. Now, if you focus on that sentence, we immediately get the right semantics compositionally. So the compositional semantics of 5b is 7b is 7c, quite obviously. So we just need to assume that in the claim that S acts sort of as a modifier, semantically involving predication of S, the sentence S, of the claim. So the claim that S would then stand for an attitudinal object that has the content given by S. And then make naturally expresses a relation between agents and things that are of the nature of claims. And so we have the logical form then of 7a. We don't need to make any assumptions about Davidsonian events. We can just set this issue completely aside. So focusing on sentences like 5b, we get immediately a compositional semantics that goes along with this view of object-based truth-maker semantics. Then now one can note that this more complex predicate in 7b is actually quite common. So sometimes, in fact, we only have this complex predicate and not the simple one. For example, have the impression that, or in German, Angst haben, have fear. So often in languages we have the complex form rather than the simple verbal form, which one could take to be some support for the view that one may just want to focus on the complex form. But then one can also look at some recent syntactic literature where it has been argued that, in fact, the simple sentence in 7a is derived syntactically from a sentence like 7b. And that has been argued for doxastic attitude reports by Boban Arsijenevich, as well as for certain sorts of modal sentences by Stephanie Harvest and Richard Kane. And they had purely syntactic considerations. They didn't have an ontology of modal and attitudinal objects in mind, or truth-maker semantics or anything. They just had purely syntactic considerations, concerns about the syntactic status of complement clauses, and so on. Boban Arsijenevich's analysis, 7a, or like 9a, is derived from in the way indicated in 9b. So I'm not going into the details, it's just very quickly. The verb claim starts out as sort of make, and then the noun claim, which is found inside the that clause. And then that noun claim moves up incorporates into the verb, and it's spelled out as the verb claim. So it incorporates into the light verb make, and then the make claim is spelled out as the verb claim. So crucially, the verb claim is derived from the complex predicate with the claim originating as a noun inside the that clause. Then one can just say, well, the sentence it's interpreted with respect to its underlying structure, which is basically like John made the claim that S. And on that view, that S is treated as a special kind of relative clause. So one can just make use of that syntactic analysis, immediately gets the logical form in 7C. And then on Harves and Keynes' view, a sense like 8A is derived from something like 8B. So again, the verb need is underlyingly have need. So light verb, noun. Need here is considered a noun, and it takes to leave as a sort of relative clause. And it moves up and incorporates into the light verb have, and then it's pronounced need as a verb. And again, one can just take that analysis and interpret the underlying syntactic structure and get the logical form of modal senses as roughly in 6b. Yeah, so there are syntactic analyses on which simple attitude reports and modal senses have this more complex underlying syntactic structure that would give us immediately the right kind of logical form. Of course, one has to justify that farther and show that it applies to all attitude reports and modal senses of the relevant sort, given the fact that there are syntacticians that maintain that view, is also already a challenge to the standard view that it's not at all obvious that that clauses act as sort of arguments of an attitude verb or even modal predicate standing for a proposition, providing a propositional argument. Then on the handout, I just have some indications of how this account would apply to these quantifiers like something or everything or relative pronouns what. So I think something is not a quantifier that would range over propositions, but rather it ranges, in fact, over attitudinal objects or modal objects. An indication is that like a restriction like shocking in 10A could not possibly be understood as a predicate of propositions. And then one can pursue an analysis in sort of the spirit of Arjenevich, where one would then have a compositional semantics of 10A as being based on something like 10C. And then also reports of shared contents of different attitudes are subject to particular constraints, which also indicate that they, in fact, do not report abstract propositions being shared, like in 11A and A, but rather they report a type of attitudinal object being shared. One indication for that is that 11A is just sort of as bad as 11B. And the explanation would again be that the underlying syntactic structure has an interpretation that involves just attitudinal objects or kinds of them and not propositions. So I don't know, I don't need to go into the details of that. It's just a further motivation and a way of solving one set of problems for the standard view. Yeah, now we can come to clausal complements that can no longer be viewed as just predicates predicated of the attitudinal object that sort of corresponds to the embedding attitude verb. So one attitude verb where one wouldn't be able to apply this account anymore is factive verbs. So one can make three relevant observations here. So certain sorts of factive verbs or predicates like regret or was unexpected allow for the substitution of like a that clause, that as, by the fact that as, which is already a sort of indication that the account that I've outlined so far is not applicable here. Then another important observation is the understanding of partially with those factive predicates, like in 14a and 14b. 14a is actually not really acceptable. John partly thinks that as. That would be predicted because there isn't really something that is provided by that as that has a partial content. Rather, that S is just a predicate of an attitudinal object, and that's not available for partly here. But in John partly regrets that everybody failed the exam or so, here you partly is acceptable. And what it picks out is some of the partial content of a fact. And then a third relevant observation is that when one nominalizes a factive predicate of the relevant sort, then one doesn't in fact get a sort of new attitudinal object. We get a different interpretation of nominalizations than with attitude verbs like claim. So in 15b, the unexpectedness, that S was unexpected, so the unexpectedness that S, here the unexpectedness that S stands for sort of a quality of a fact. It doesn't stand for something that has a content that can be satisfied or so. So it stands for let's say, a trope of a fact, something like that. So normalizations work differently with these sorts of factive predicates. So it has been suggested in the by various linguists that factive complements involve, in fact, sort of nominal complement and an implicit noun fact. I wouldn't quite want to adopt that view, but I would adopt the view that there is some sort of fact feature that can be of a nominal nature, perhaps, that plays a role. So for the relation between regret and the complement clause, we have then the structure in 16. And what is important then is that that S will act as a predicate of facts, where facts would not be truth maker situations, but rather they could be disjunctive or quantificational, that would be non-worldly facts. And now with this ontology I made use of, one can get easily an ontological account of facts in that sense, also in the sense that they come with a content that divides into partial content. So one can say the fact that S is just the modal object whose satisfiers are the actual situations of that are truth makers of the sense S, and then that modal object doesn't have violators. And then one can formulate the meaning of a complement clause of a factive predicate like regret as in 18. So it is so S together with this fact feature will then stand for the property of objects that shares the verifiers of the sense S as its verifiers insofar as they are actual, and then they do not come with violators. Yeah, then sometimes one needs, in addition to facts, also, I think, states of affairs. So like that S is likely, or the likelihood that S. Again, here you do not have normalizations leading to terms for attitudinal objects, but rather qualities of states of affairs. Now, states of affairs one can also straightforwardly conceive of as modal objects. They would just be modal objects that have as their satisfiers the satisfiers of the sentence S, and then they do not come with violators. And now I come to what I had mentioned before, the possibility that complement clauses are in fact predicates predicated of truth makers, rather than content bearers that share the satisfiers and perhaps falsifiers of the sentence. So they are both verbal and nominal constructions where that can be the case. So examples for verbs that take complement clauses that act as predicates of truth makers are given in 21a, b, and c. So it has never occurred that John was late. So that John was late here is obviously not predicated of a modal or attitudinal object. It's a predicated of a particular, let's say, event or situation. And of course, that event or situation is just a truth maker of the sentence that John was late. Similarly, for it has once happened that John was late. And then in 21c, you have B acting as a verb, taking a complement clause that acts as a predicate of a truth maker. So could it be that John is late? So is there basically a situation S that is a truth maker of John is late? And then one can say, yeah, that is so. So this construction is more limited, so one cannot say that John is late is or is so, but you have to, that there are constraints for B acting as a predicate of truth makers that forces it to be in questions or other sorts of contexts. And then we also have nominal constructions where a complement clause acts as a predicate of truth makers. And that's described in my recent LNP article on case constructions, like the case in which John was late. Here, the in which clause acts as a predicate of a situation, a case, which is a truth maker of John was late. And in which clauses and that clauses, in fact, are quite similar. In some languages, here we have that clauses and so on. So how, what is happening here is, I think that a sentence, that clause is assigned a different truth maker based meaning. So it no longer expresses a property of content bearers that share their satisfiers with the sentence, but rather it expresses a property of truth makers of the sentence. So that's what we have in 23. So I think, in fact, this alternation between a sentence expressing a property of content bearers that and a property of truth makers is available for all types of sentences. So not just that clauses, but also WH clauses and infinitival clauses. So now we can quickly look at WH clauses. So one can make the assumption that WH clause, like who won the race, has as its satisfiers not particular situations or actions, but rather objects that are locutionary objects or maybe other sorts of truth-directed objects whose satisfiers in turn are the truth makers of, like, A won the race for relevant entity A. And then who won the race can function somewhat differently in different contexts and be associated with different, in a way, truth-maker-based meanings in different contexts. So it can act semantically as a predicate of questions, like in 25a, John asked, who came, or who won the race, sorry. So here, who won the race would act as a predicate of questions which have as their satisfiers locutionary acts, so answers, that in turn have as their satisfiers situations or actions. And then in 25b, John wondered who came, or who won the race. Who won the race would be predicated of a state of inquiry, which is sort of almost on a par with questions, except that it has as its satisfiers sort of pieces of knowledge, which have as their satisfiers actual situations, like of somebody winning the race. So here I said like what the feature that is relevant is sort of plus fact prime. It's not quite what we have in with these other factive complements, but rather it's a somewhat variation on that. And then we can have 25C, John told me who came, where who won the race would be predicated of a locutionary object that has the status of an answer. And then for that we would have just this assignment function that I had used before for verbs of occurrence. We can use exactly the same. So two assignment functions that assign truthmaker-based meanings to sentences can be reused in exactly the same way for WH clauses. And then a quick look at infinitival clauses, let's say to run. So very much simplifying, we can, let's say infinitival clauses are sentences that have as satisfiers actions. And then to run can again be assigned to truthmaker-based meanings so that it can apply as a predicate semantically with those meanings, one of which would be as a predicate of illocutionary objects. That's what we would need for 24A, John requested to run. So to run is predicated of a request, and the request here has as its satisfiers actions. And these actions would be satisfiers of the sentence to run, and they would be satisfiers of the attitudinal object that's the request. So we can just reuse this one assignment function that assigns a sentence a truthmaker-based content, except that we have here as satisfiers only actions. And then this other assignment function also plays a role sometimes with infinitival complements, namely that assigns the sentence as its meaning just a property of its satisfiers, namely actions. That's what we would need in 24b. So John managed to run. So here to run is predicated of something that is somehow described by manage, and that is just an action. So here we just can use this other assignment function where a sentence is assigned a truthmaker-based meaning on the basis of the satisfiers of the sentence, or the sentence can then act as a predicate of those satisfiers, and the satisfiers here are actions. Yeah, so then to conclude on this view, clauses can always be viewed as predicates, semantically predicated of attitudinal and modal objects, sometimes of facts or states of affairs, or in fact of truth makers or satisfiers, which can be situations or actions or illocutionary objects. Now, in this talk, I focused on the formal options that are provided by this object-based truthmaker semantics. Of course, now a great amount of work is to be done of comparing the advantages of this approach when applied to particular constructions or cases, over the alternatives. And that in turn requires quite a lot of linguistic argumentation, including now, of course, a lot of syntactic work. But I think the whole topic of attitude reports and to an extent modal sentences, as it was discussed in semantics and philosophy, was based on naive linguistic views, especially naive syntactic views of what, in fact, the syntactic structure of the relevant sentences is. And so I think here linguistics really plays a very important role in providing support for possibly a very different way of dealing with the semantics of attitude reports and modal sentences.